their names here is online.
Okay, at this time we'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. We have with us at this time Representative Brown, Representative Varr, Representative Parnell, and myself, Larson. Today on our agenda we have four pieces of legislation: Senate Bill 19, House Bill 28, House Bill 132, and House Bill 195. Senate Bill 19 was rolled over to today's calendar from last week. So we will start with Senate Bill 19 first. Senate Bill 19 is an act relating to the crime of conspiracy. This bill was heard in committee before. It was placed into a subcommittee consisting of Representative Hanley as chairman and members Parnell and Hoffman. The bill is targeted at organized crime. And at this time, I'd like to recognize Representative Hanley for the events that took place between the time in which we put it in subcommittee till now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just explain to folks that we actually had a House version of the conspiracy bill that went into a subcommittee before the Senate bill actually made it to the House, and had worked on some changes to the different versions and had come up with a bill, basically, that was acceptable to the subcommittee anyway, at which point the Senate bill passed the Senate, came over to the House, was referred to the Finance Committee. The Senate bill is essentially the bill that we had worked on, the changed version that we had done with the House bills, so that there was no, it was assigned to subcommittee, and I talked to the members of the subcommittee, and it was essentially the same as what we had worked on, so there wasn't a need to adopt a separate, any changes, I guess, there, from what we had adopted as a subcommittee on the House versions.
Okay, so as I understand it then, we've had a vehicle in the House and a vehicle in the Senate. The Senate bill came over first, so what is before us now should be committee substitute for Senate Bill number 19, Finance Amended. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so that will be the bill that will be for us today, and that's the bill then in which we will take testimony on. Do you have any brief statements by members of the committee before we open it up to the public hearing? I'd like to note for the record that Representative Terrio is also here. Representative Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll raise a point of order that I raised on the floor this morning and note that this bill has come through a committee that was not constituted correctly under the uniform rules, and for that reason, I don't think it's in order that we should consider it.
Okay, your objection has been noted. Anything else? Representative Hoffman has joined us, and Representative Grusendorf. Okay, so at this time, then, we could move to the public hearing. I noticed on teleconference we have Mr. Art Snowden, First Sergeant Crawford, Brant Mayu?
McGee.
Okay, I can't read the writing here. Maybe we should ask, are there any of those who would like to give any testimony here to start with on teleconference?
Mr. Chairman, this is John Salemi from the Public Defender Agency. I noticed you didn't mention my name, and I wish to give testimony also regarding fiscal impact for the public defender at the appropriate time.
Okay. I noticed that the prime sponsor of the bill, Senator Helfert, is here, so maybe to start out we could recognize Senator Helfert. Senator, welcome to House Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've been working on this one so long that I think probably people that have been in the legislature a while have seen it before. I think we've passed it several times from the Senate. I'd be glad to answer any questions, but it's really fairly self-explanatory. It creates a separate crime. Some will tell you that separate crime will result in increases in prosecution costs, and some will tell you that it won't. I think the experience of other jurisdictions that it hasn't, but it does result in possibly more convictions. So I would say that if you're looking at fiscal notes for where the reality is, I think maybe the corrections fiscal note is more justified than fiscal notes in public defenders, public advocates, and in the prosecution side or in the court side. But I'd be glad to answer any specific questions. Other than that, I would encourage you to move expeditiously. As you know, the recent case in Anchorage that we've been familiar with regard to minors is also a potential conspiracy case, which probably will not be able to be joined and treated that way, of course, because the bill is not law.
Are there any questions of Senator Helfert? Or Senator Brown?
Thank you. Senator, on page 1, line 6 of your bill, the word agrees is the primary verb that we're to look to determine whether a conspiracy has occurred. And I'm wondering, would you object to inserting the words after agrees and communicates the agreement to the other person or persons? So that would read, the offender agrees and communicates the agreement. And my point in proposing this is that the way that it now sits, it's a very vague word, the word agree. And I believe it would be clearer and stronger if we added some action there, as well as just the nebulous word agree.
Well, the question, if you follow the sentence, the person has to agree and then do some overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. And the agreement is not the conspiracy. It's the combination of the agreement and the overt act. So I don't think it's necessary. As far as the semantics of doing it, I would rather let the attorneys kind of go back and forth in terms of what that means. But I believe it requires both agreement and overt act.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Brown?
Well, that I would feel better if it did require that, but you see on line 7, it says, and the offender or one of the persons does an overt act. So you might be in this conversation and never do any act and yet be brought into this conspiracy. So I'm trying to get to a clearer way of saying what is it that brings about the crime of conspiracy and how a person would get charged with that. I don't believe the way this is written now would require the overt act on your part, on the part of the person agreeing and being charged.
No, you're correct that the overt act does not have to be done by each individual charged in the conspiracy. There has to be an overt act, and there has to be agreement by each person. I think that in terms of the conspiracy laws, federal and in various states, you know, there are a lot of different standards that are applied. Some are how easy it is to get in and get out, to start the conspiracy or become a part of it, how easy it is to renounce it, whether your penalties are the same, whether they come down one step. All those things are the variables that are in all the conspiracy laws across the states. I believe that this one is far from the most or the highest level of conspiracy statutes in the states or in the federal government even. But I would rather you talk to the people in the legal field with regard to exactly what that does.
But I gather you're open to discussing it further.
Well, I'm open to discussing it further. I think this statute does not intend to be the harshest conspiracy law by any means, and it is not. But by the same token, it needs to be strong enough that it is in fact workable, because the same individual has some reasonable conditions under which they can divorce themselves from anything to do with the conspiracy as well.
What I'm going to do is kind of move on today into the public hearing portion. When it comes to amending the bill, we'll have plenty of time for amendments after we hear from the public testimony. Okay, let's move to Ankerson on the teleconference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you, President Helfer. Could we hear from Mr. Snowden if he has any remarks in Anchorage, followed by First Sergeant Crawford?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Art Snowden. I'm Administrative Director of the Judicial Branch of Government. The judiciary takes no position whatsoever on the bill. We do have a strong position vis-a-vis the fiscal impact. We did put a fiscal note on the bill in the Senate, and it was zeroed out. The Department of Law isn't assuming, I guess, any new prosecutions and said there may be two or three cases a year. Our problem with this is as follows, that similar legislation, as President Halper just stated, the Senate passed this bill many times, was considered in 1987. The Department of Law projected the need for two additional attorneys, a paralegal, a secretary. They indicated a potentially huge caseload. OPA has estimated it will defend 25 co-defendants. Last Friday when District Attorney McNally was talking, and again when the President was talking today, they said if we had the law, we'd use it for this juvenile who was allegedly part of killing a taxi driver. So we think the law will be used. Now, what effect will it have on us if it does? I've talked to many, many criminal judges, judges of the Court of Appeals, justices of the Supreme Court. Agreement is almost unanimous in this branch of government. That will certainly mean longer trials because you're going to have more defendants, which means that judge will be tied up and won't be able to do as many trials. It will also, in our view, mean bifurcated trials, which means split trials, where one person accuses another one in the conspiracy of being at fault. You may have to have a lot more trials. So we really believe that our workload will go up substantially. We have not allowed in our fiscal note for any increased juror costs, any increased electrical, or any of those types of things. What we've just tried to do is add some pro tem help, which are retired judges, and the cheapest way we can go to offset some of the caseload. Our civil caseload, by the way, is already up 16% this year. Our bench is quite busy at this point. I don't know how we get over the hurdle whether there will be cases or not cases. I'd be more than willing, Mr. Chairman, from our point of view, to see the Senate give us the legislature give us our fiscal note, put intent on it, saying that if six cases or pick a number aren't filed, then we will return the money to the Treasury. But the Department of Law says there'll only be three cases. I'm just picking a number that's twice that number. We are quite concerned about the cost and about the length and delay in court procedures. So with that, we would hope that the House would consider very seriously passing on our fiscal note.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Snowden. Representative Terrio and then Brown, what she's looking for, whatever she's looking.
Yes, Mr. Snowden, have you offset some of that supposed cost by the fact that now some cases will be taken together, kind of joined, where the jury gets to see the whole act instead of one person being charged with driving the car and maybe one person being charged with something else? So there may have been multiple court cases that now will be tried together. And how will we really count up the number of cases that are charged under this new conspiracy charge, because they may have been charged under something else previously if this passes?
Mr. Chairman, my view is that they will make all the charges that they have at their disposal, serious charges, lesser included charges. I'm just suggesting that if conspiracy is specifically charged, that's a good way to count it. These will not replace other charges that alleged perpetrators of crime would be charged with. Generally, these other cases, they're treated as accomplices. They will possibly get separate trials right now, bifurcated trials, saying I wasn't an accomplice, I didn't have anything to do with it, and they could create more trials being created within the conspiracy. At least that's what our Superior Court judges think, that they will be much longer. And in fact, is we're worried about the number of courtrooms within the system at this point in time that can handle multiple defendants. We've got one in Anchorage, one in Fairbanks, and one in Juneau. So it would be very difficult at this time to be carrying on multiple trials. that require a lot of defense attorneys and a lot of defendants at one point in time. Very difficult.
Okay, any other questions to Mr. Snowden? Okay, let's move on then to First Sergeant Crawford and then Brent McGee will follow.
Mr. Chairman, this is First Sergeant Crawford. I'm only available to answer questions. So I don't have testimony this afternoon.
Okay, thank you, sir. Brent?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, and John Cellini will be next.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brent McGee. I'm the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. My primary function is the representation of abused and neglected children, ordinarily in child in need of aid proceedings. We do, however, have a criminal defense function, which we perform when the public defender agency has a conflict of interest. Because of the nature of this particular offense, we are assuming in the creation of our fiscal note a large number, or a relatively small number of cases. Out of all the total of people who will be charged with conspiracy, it is very likely the Office of Public Advocacy will represent in excess of 75% of those defendants. We are making a couple of other assumptions as well. One is that nearly all of the individuals charged will be indigent for the purposes of prosecution under this statute. The court system makes determinations of indigency. We do not, but certainly in our experience, it is our experience that well in excess of 95% of individuals charged with serious crimes are dependent upon public agencies for their defense. Our next assumption is that these cases will be intensely litigated, not only because it is a new statute, but because the trials of such actions will involve multiple lawyers. For that reason, such trials will be very, very expensive. Let me tell you why. I have heard it argued that rather than having numerous trials involving individual co-defendants, there will be one big trial involving all the co-defendants, and therefore it will be cheaper. Let me tell you why that is an utter fallacy. Let us suppose that six individuals are charged as part of a drug distribution ring, and suppose further that trials on each of these individuals would involve 10 trial days. If the public defender agency represented one of the individuals and OPA was responsible for the defense of the other five, OPA would be paying for a total of 50 trial days out of those six trials. However, if the individuals are tried together, that will mean that all of the defendants and each of their attorneys will be present throughout the entire conspiracy trial. No one believes that a conspiracy trial is going to be any shorter than any of the individual trials would be. In fact, it is going to be significantly longer. I think anyone with experience, even the slightest bit of experience in litigation, understands that the more lawyers you have involved in the process, the longer it is going to be. Some people have even posited that it's an exponential growth in time when you begin to add lawyers to a particular litigation stew, and I believe in that theory. Let's assume further that the trial only lasts three times as long. That is, there are 30 trial days involved. If that is the case, that means that OPA would be responsible for paying for not just 50 trial days, but 150 trial days. Therefore, for the prosecution of and defense of these individuals, our costs would jump more than three times than they would be if the people were prosecuted under the substantive charge alone. It is for that reason that the Office of Public Advocacy is projecting an initial cost in FY95 of $514,000. I'd also be happy, Mr. Chairman, to respond to any questions from any members of the panel. Thank you.
Thank you. So far in testimony, we've heard lots of discussion as to the cost of this bill. We haven't heard any discussion in results to whether the crime of conspiracy and having that as put on the books is good or bad. So do we have anyone who wants to speak in regards to the bill? And then we will discuss the fiscal notes later. Going down the list here, we do have a person that has signed up himself here, Patrick Conahy?
Conahy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pat Conahy. I'm a attorney in private practice. I don't represent any groups, and I'm not on the state payroll here. This is my time. And my personal opinions on this. I have had some experience in the criminal justice system on both sides of the fence, and I've been fortunate or unfortunate to have accepted appointments both on the federal level and on the state level, and have defended a conspiracy case on the federal level. Generally speaking, and I've been around for a few years, I see no need for conspiracy law. I think Dick McGee's, in his fiscal note, kind of underscores that in his commentary, the fiscal note. We're just going to use this to lump on to other charges to give us a better bargaining position is basically how I read what he's saying. That's, at least in my opinion, a very poor public policy reason for enacting a new criminal statute all the way around. Conspiracy doesn't add anything to existing law. Now, a lot of people have expressed views in writing regarding the need to have a conspiracy law to track down some drug offenders or some murderers. I personally don't see that. Perchance, one area where there could be a need for a conspiracy law, and if this body really seriously would consider a conspiracy law, I think it would be in the nature of crimes charged under 1156, which are crimes against public administration, because that's probably the area where it's most difficult as a prosecutor to get a handle on what is going on. In essence, the final thing I'd like to say, and again, I don't have a budget in front of this committee, so I don't want to speak to it from that point of view, but I will say that it is substantially more expensive to prosecute and or defend a conspiracy, or at least to defend a conspiracy charge. You have a number of factors which you do not normally consider if you're defending a substantive charge that come into play, including additional attorneys on it. In OPA cases versus federal public defender cases that I have seen or that I have undertaken where conspiracy was involved, the amount that was billed to the government agencies was at least four times what normally is billed. It's a lot of money for no real return on this law. And again, I just think it's a bad policy, unless there's a reason behind it, to be enacting new laws to make new crimes in the state. Thank you.
Any questions?
I just had one real short one here on the summary that I have here. It says, Alaska is the only state that has not passed a law similar to this one.
I don't practice anywhere else but the state of Alaska here, but again, conspiracy charges are used to gain a bargaining position. Ostensibly, our criminal justice system here has two factors built into it which no other states have also. They are a ban on plea bargaining, which we know doesn't exist, as well as a requirement for screening cases, which we also know doesn't exist. And it's unfortunate that we've let those policies slide and point our fingers to something like this. If you want to keep it down, if you want to keep it the system working right, reinstitution of those policies would probably go a lot further in doing that.
Any other questions, Representative Brown?
Where is plea bargaining addressed? How is it that it came that we don't have that?
That's too tough.
Why we don't have it or why we do have it?
I'm not sure.
The Attorney General back in, I believe, 75 issued a directive throughout the Department of Law which banned plea bargaining. In fact, it may have been a little early. It may have been 73 or 74. Mr. Guinelli, I know, is aware of the time frame, and I just can't remember. Subsequent to that, as part of the ban on plea bargaining, which is as important, is that the Attorney General also issued a directive regarding adoption of the ABA standards regarding screening of criminal cases. The only time that the screening of criminal cases or that standard is ever applied is when we're talking about prosecution of public figures. And it's always given as the reason we don't. We don't apply it to poor people. We don't apply it to natives. We don't apply it to uniformly throughout the state. And it's probably beside the point here on the conspiracy.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, at this time, can we hear from Mr. McNally?
Pardon? Oh, you have mentioned Salimi from Anchorage. Maybe after the last guy. And ask if I am again.
Okay. And then following Mr. McNally, we'll have Mr. Salini from Anchorage testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have addressed this committee or many of the members who are here today on this issue in Anchorage, so I won't belabor some of the points that have already been addressed, but I'd like to try and respond to some of the things that have been raised already today, and especially, Mr. Chairman, your direct question, is this a good law or a bad law? Alaska is the only state in the country that doesn't have this law. It is a basic, bread-and-butter, ordinary piece of law enforcement. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not an exotic law. It's not a boutique law like the stalking law that captured America's attention over the last 3 years. This is a law like a robbery statute or something that makes it a crime to assault someone violently with a firearm. It raises no particular constitutional questions. It's been on the books for decades. Alaskans have been subject to this law for decades. There are Alaskans who have been convicted by juries of Alaskans under federal law, Alaska federal juries. Their cases have been appealed, and they've been upheld on appeal. Again, there are no constitutional due process or other questions that are being raised. And as we sit in this room deciding whether or not Alaska should have a conspiracy law at all, there are Alaskans in prison all over the country who are in jail for conspiring. And they were put there, as I say, by Alaska juries. So it already exists. And one of the questions that we should be asking is, do we want to just give this up to the federal government and have federal prosecutors, like I used to be, the only ones who make these decisions about drug traffickers who are poisoning our children in this state, or people who are raiding our white-collar institutions, or people who are committing conspiracies to do things like send a bomb through the mail to kill innocent Alaskans in Chugiak? I think that's the question, is whether we want to simply give that up to the federal government, or whether you would prefer that Alaska prosecutors, Alaska judges, and so forth, under Alaska state law, take this role. There are many disadvantages to the fact that I have not been in Alaska for a terribly long time, but maybe one minor advantage is I was a federal prosecutor in a pretty nasty place, New York City, and there was hardly a case that the federal government charges where conspiracy isn't part of it, because, again, it's a very basic bread and butter thing. And as the federal officials get cycled through here, as FBI agents come up, most of you have heard direct testimony from Bertie Passanelli or Wiley Thompson, the current SAC of the FBI, who are simply astonished. They don't know how law enforcement can do their job without something as basic as this. And one of the most important questions that it comes down to is an example I've used before. It's whether you want a single group of Alaskans to get all of the information in front of them and make an intelligent decision on the law and on the facts. Representative Hanley last week, in talking about the juvenile waiver law, pointed out that one of the advantages of shifting the burden is that it probably will increase the chances that psychiatrists are examining the young kids who are alleged to have committed these crimes, and let the finder of fact, in that case a judge, have all of the cards, or as many as possible, face up in front of them to make an informed and just decision. Well, the same thing is frequently true in a conspiracy case, and let me go directly to a couple of examples of that. Art Snowden mentioned that both myself as district attorney in Anchorage and Senator Halford earlier today referred to this recent case of the taxi cab killing in Anchorage and the fact that it involves both juvenile waiver questions and conspiracy. Unfortunately, I don't have the information charging document with me. It's across the street. I can make copies available to any of you who are interested. It is a public document. But it charges something like 8 to 10 counts. I don't know the exact number. Those counts include murder, robbery, and a variety of weapons and drug counts. Typically, what will happen in the Alaska system today is what we know very familiar. I have another charging document of a case that is already discussed more freely. It's the state of Alaska versus Tanya Fowler and Stephen Taylor. And I can provide copies of this information to you if you would like as well. In essence, it charges two serious cocaine shipments, both a kilo or more, coming out of Seattle to Anchorage. Just what the cops tell us is the problem. Obviously, none of the cocaine comes from inside Alaska. And Stephen Fowler is accused of having brought cocaine up on December 17th of 1991 and then working in tandem with Stephen Taylor and Tanya Fowler, with Tanya Fowler on January 11th and 13th of 1992. In other words, these are two transactions, two shipments about a month apart. Fowler's method was he was the controller of the operation and she was the mule. She physically carried the cocaine. He was clean. He was sitting in a different part of the plane, didn't go through security with her, and this is a standard methodology in drug transportation. Have a more innocent-looking female carry the stuff, and if she gets caught, you have clean hands, you're not carrying drugs, you're not carrying a gun. The whole purpose of this operation is to fool you. It's to fool Alaska cops. It's to fool Alaska troopers, airport security, legislatures and the laws they pass, prosecutors like myself, and ultimately Alaska juries. And we, under current law, play right into it. We make it much easier for them to do that. And here's what happens. The Superior Court in Anchorage looked at a simple two-count indictment that a grand jury of fellow Alaskans handed up. Two counts. Count one, charged both Taylor and Fowler with the January 12th delivery. Count two, charged just Stephen Taylor with the December 17th delivery. The Superior Court, having heard defense applications, broke this simple one-month story of two people doing drugs together into three separate trials. There was going to be one group of 12 Alaskans to hear about what Stevie Taylor did on January 12th, and a second group of 12 Alaskans would talk about what Tanya Fowler did on January 12th, and a third group of 12 Alaskans would look at what Stephen Taylor did on December 17th. As I've used this example before, it's like the six blind men and the elephant, where one jury gets to just see the tail, and another just feels the side of the elephant, and a third just feels the trunk. And no jury sees the true picture of what actually happened in the real world. And isn't that exactly what we want? We want judges who are going to rule on evidence, keep out prejudicial evidence, and we've got a constitution and a good set of laws, the criminal rules of evidence, that protect that. But we want them to see the full picture to the extent. And in this most recent case that I just mentioned, the cab case with 8 to 10 charges, guns, drugs, murder, robbery, potentially that could be fractured all over the map. And I'll give you a copy of the information and you'll see the whole story, and you may see something here in this committee room that's in the public already that no Alaska jury will ever get to see the whole story just once. So part of what we're really talking about there is justice. It's not just a question of dollars and cents and courthouse efficiency and everything else. The other thing to remember is that when we're talking about narcotics, the majority of cases in the Anchorage office that we would use this bill for would be narcotics cases. There will be occasional murder cases. There will be occasional robbery cases. Not very likely that we're going to see a lot of rape conspiracies. Not very likely that we're going to see certain other categories. But in narcotics, I know those of you who represent Anchorage have driven through the neighborhoods, and you've seen what's going on. These are people who do this for a living. They have roles. Some are suppliers. Some guard the stash. Some stand out in the street. Some steer customers. They're working together, and that's what they do for a living. And in 49 states, state prosecutors like myself bring those people into court and make sure that they're tried together as well. The real problem with having only federal conspiracy laws is that the threshold of how serious the crime has to be before the feds will take the case and charge it as conspiracy is enormously high. So Alaska doesn't have the nightmare problem of 10 kilos of cocaine being delivered. That's a typical federal case. What we need is a basic conspiracy law so we can go after those mutts in Mountain View and sometimes Spinard and Fairview and other hard-hit areas that are really destroying the quality of life of those communities. And in addition, we need to protect rural Alaska by not just lopping off the people who happen to be selling in the interior, but driving back to the people in Anchorage who are supplying them and who are really profiting from dumping poison into our rural Alaska communities. I'd like to respond briefly to what Mr. McGee had to say in his presentation, and it's possible that Mr. Salemi will raise some similar questions. Mr. McGee presented no basis for two assumptions he made in his figures. One assumption was an average of five defendants. And the other assumption was that an average trial length would be three times the current length. I am aware of no basis for any such figure. My own projection is that the average conspiracy case in Anchorage, the hard-hit urban part of the state, would be one, two, or three defendants. Five, I think, would be very unusual. And an average might well be just two. And I am aware of no basis for suggesting that a trial would be three times the length. I think that a one-week-long trial might be a day or two longer, maybe 3 days longer, but nothing like twice as long, certainly nothing like three times as long. But even assuming the correctness of Mr. McGee's analysis, what he's presenting to you is something that might be more costly for the defense counsel part of the formula. Several lawyers spending a slightly longer period of time in one big trial than they would if they tried each of their defendants individually. But even assuming that analysis, we're talking about less time at trial for the court system, Superior Court judge, the courtroom itself, the clerks and secretaries involved, less time for the Alaskans who are called to jury service, and less time for the Department of Law and their prosecutors. So of the four components at the trial stage, three will save money, and one might be somewhat more expensive. And my expectation is that would more than balance out. Now, I'll talk about something that isn't very often candidly addressed. When we talk about whether there's going to be more or less money, I've got some news. Conspiracy cases don't go to trial. One of the reasons they don't go to trial is because if the conspiracy laws are defined and upheld here in Alaska, unlike the current case where Tanya Fowler and Steve Taylor can sit back with their court-appointed lawyers and laugh at us knowing that we've got to go into court three different trials in order to really bring them to justice, they know under a conspiracy statute that those 12 Alaskans are going to see the whole thing. And the hope that they can just scam us in plea discussions quickly falls away. So with a conspiracy rule, you know, we never see any federal trials. And one of the reasons you don't is because under an ordinary conspiracy statute, the defendants recognize and their lawyers recognize that it's all going to come in. And frankly, that's one of the reasons why any number of defense lawyers would rather not see this law pass. It's going to increase the possibility, the probability, that their clients will be convicted. They are advocates. It's what they're paid to do, and we all respect that. So a conspiracy is not just this add-on to existing laws. It, in fact, would do something very significant. Also, if I may, I would like to address Representative Brown's question that she posed to the President of the Senate about communicating. Under this law that's been proposed, Alaskans would be subject to a very simple but at the same time detailed conspiracy law. And we would have to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, each and every element of the crime as laid out. And that means we have to prove that they intended to agree. We have to prove that they actually did agree, and we have to prove that an overt act was done in furtherance of it. If we fail to convince even one of the 12 on any one of those three questions alone, we lose. There is no conviction. Adding a fourth element, adding in addition to proving that they did agree, that they acted in furtherance of it, and that they intended to do both of those things, that we also have to prove to a jury that they communicated it through words, is going to make it's going to water down this statute, it's going to make it tougher to obtain convictions, and it's going to give defense counsel, when they don't have a case in the world, a wonderful element to prove. Sure, Mr. McNally has proven that this guy participated in it. He proved that this guy agreed to participate in it, and he even approved that he acted in furtherance. But Mr. McNally, since he doesn't have any wiretaps or any informant information, has never proven that he ever said the magic words. So even though you know he acted in it and intended to it, you've got to acquit him, ladies and gentlemen, because Mr. McNally didn't prove that he said the magic words. This is the kind of technicality that can cause people to lose faith in our system of criminal justice. And I know, respectfully, that it's not intended in any sense to do that. And I know that that's not your intention or anyone else's intention who suggested it. But I think its ultimate effect would be providing a defense where there is no defense and where there shouldn't be, and we don't want to create it artificially. Beyond that, I'm happy to discuss any aspect of this and Mr. Guinelli from the Criminal Division and Margot Knuth from the Criminal Division, as well as the Commissioner of Public Safety, Richard Burton, are also here to discuss the administration's position. Thank you.
And we had Representative Navarre, then Brown.
First of all, so in the fracturing of cases, when you employ the conspiracy law, there will be no more fracturing of cases where the conspiracy law is employed.
It's going to be extremely difficult. Right now, I am told by members of the legislature that they've worked for years to try and reduce the number of times on joinder and severance, that the judges are splitting things up. And they have physically pulled their hair, as they described. They thought they had fixed these rules, and still cases are being severed. There will be one important case where cases will and are throughout the United States severed on conspiracy, and that is when you have a myriad of overlapping confessions. The case is called Bruton, and if you have a Bruton problem where the different members have given separate confessions, the state is not permitted to put all of them in courtroom and throw all the overlapping confessions out there. The state has to make a choice. They either try the case without the confessions because they have enough other evidence, or they do split them up and they try them one by one of the crime of conspiracy, but using their individual confessions only against them. The idea is that if John Doe and I conspire together and we give these finger-pointing kind of confessions, the fact that I confess doesn't necessarily have to come in against him. The conspiracy ended when I gave my confession to a police officer.
So, in fact, it won't end all the fracturing of cases.
There's nothing any legislature could do to put a stop to that.
That's fine. Thank you. The other thing is, it's your opinion that the court system, the impact on the court system will be minimal or none at all?
I believe it would be. I haven't seen their fiscal note, and I have not heard or read the analysis that I'm sure Mr. Snowden and his staff very carefully put into it. From my perspective, based on my experience, there would be fewer trials because cases would plead out, and those that do go to trial would be more efficient from the court system point of view.
So you think they'll save money, basically?
I think that's entirely possible.
Okay, and if we choose in passing this out to go with a zero fiscal note based on that testimony, how about if we say that if the court system can document that they have additional costs, they take it out of the Department of Law? I mean, it's easy to say that it's not going to cost something, and I expect that you'll take some actions, or the Department of Law will take some actions, probably to try to keep costs down one way or another in the Department of Law through the use of this. But, you know, generally the court system has been very good about the budget, small increases in their budget at all based on caseloads. And I guess I have a tendency to give more credibility to the court system and their testimony and their need, demonstrated need for additional resources than I do people who are strong advocates for or against the legislation. I guess that's it.
I would add one thing, Representative, with regard to that is Alaska has a unique advantage that almost no other state has, only a handful do, is because of the unified system of the Department of Law, the Attorney General stands atop a pipeline where they can close that
our system, and in fact I would hope that the prosecution would do a little better job of screening some of the cases. I think that often what happens is a little bit of pride gets caught up, so once something is charged and they try to plead it down regardless of whether or not there was a crime there, and I think that a little more a better screening process might help ferret out some of the cases that I think in some cases innocent Alaskans are being held out for a long time until finally the prosecution decides, well, we really didn't have anything anyway, but since you won't plead down to something lesser so we can hang you for something because we charged originally, all right, we're going to let you go after much cost. And so it's got to be a balance. On the other hand, I don't want you to let one single person go who has broken the laws of the state, but there's got to be a balance, a better balance, a better screening process, I think, might help.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to pursue a little bit your comments about agreeing and what you would have to actually show. How would you show that someone actually did agree to something if they didn't communicate that?
Largely by inference, which the law permits us to do, and prosecutors would be standing in front of Alaska juries and say, how do you know these two agreed to rob the bank together? Do you know what one said to the other? Let's assume it's just two people and that neither has given any kind of confession. Well, the fact that they drove up together, the fact that one bought the gun and was the registered owner, but the other one actually had the gun in his hand during the crime itself. The fact that they walked into the bank together, that one said, everybody get down, while the other leapt over the counter and scooped up the money, walked out while the other covered, and they got into the same car and drove away. We would argue, and we have no wiretap, no tape recordings, no undercover wires, and no confessions from either. We don't have a single word that they ever communicated their agreement to one another. What we have is the inference that from these actions and using their common sense, a jury can infer that they did intend to conspire together to rob the bank, that they did an act in furtherance of it, aiming the gun at the people in the bank, and that would prove out the elements of the crime.
It sounds to me like in that example, both of the participants were taking overt actions, and that's really not what I'm understanding about this bill, because it sounds like, from just reading this sentence, that you could be a party to a conversation and agree to something, or I don't know what that means. I mean, does that mean you nodded your head or whatever, and that's all you ever did? And after that conversation, somebody else went out and did something. Let's say if it's bar talk, or people sitting around and say, gee, that guy's crazy, or I'm going to get that guy, or, you know, whatever somebody might say, what do you have to do to make sure that you're not agreeing to this conspiracy that these people are cooking up? I mean, it's just, if you yourself don't ever take any action other than nod your head in a conversation, do you feel that is appropriate to be charging people with a crime? And I really, you know, that's how I read this,
sure,
as to what it says.
Personal opinion, to start with, I would never charge that person, the bar talk person. And any prosecutor who did would find themselves quickly tasting the wrath of a group of 12 ordinary Alaskans. If we brought a case into court, that person, the person on the bar stool, is already protected by the entire Bill of Rights, the Alaska and the United States Constitution, the rules of evidence. And we would have to convince each and every one of the 12 jurors that that person on the bar stool agreed to do this, did so intentionally, and that an act was done intentionally in furtherance of it. And in the example you've just given, they would laugh us out of court. They'd say, Mr. McNally, all you got is a guy talking in a bar. You have not proven us beyond a reasonable doubt that he actually agreed and intended to further this conspiracy. It's not even close.
Well, I just, the word agree, if you look up the meaning of it, it's a very nebulous kind of word. And Mr. Chairman, if I could just tell an anecdote or a story that happened last session. You were at the conference table with the senators on the other side, and you made some statement like, now we all agree, or, you know, you were having trouble working something out, and you used the verb agree in a sentence, and nobody objected on the other side. The next day, you came back to the table, and they, in fact, had not agreed with that and had some other opinion. And we had this bill before us at the time. It really just reminded me that it's important that laws on which we're going to put people in jail be specific, and then it be clear what it is that one has to do to commit this crime. I mean, the only verb in here to commit this crime is the verb agree, and I don't even know what that is.
The only verb in the federal law, which is one sentence long, that our fellow Alaskans are now in prison for, is the verb conspires. It doesn't use the word agree, communicate to agree, or any other such word. Representative Brown, the extremely real doubts that are in your mind right now, and that everyone in this room, having heard your example, must share, are exactly the kind of thing that would prevent ever getting 12 jurors to concur that the state had proven an agreement beyond a reasonable doubt. If the Alaskans who sit on the juries bring the same common sense that you do to a hearing like this, and the doubts that you have would prevent any conviction from being attained. No question about it.
I'd like to ask about one other section of the bill, and that relates to entrapment. The Senate Finance Committee passed a letter of intent about entrapment that we have in our packets, and I've read that entrapment statute and tried to think about it in relation to this bill and still don't understand really what they were trying to say in this letter of intent and how the entrapment law works and how it would apply in a conspiracy case.
I have not had an opportunity to look at the letter that you're holding. I don't know if Mr. Cannelli or Ms. Knuth have had an opportunity to look at it.
Well, it's short, Mr. Chairman. I could just read it. It's just one sentence. It says, is the intent of the Senate Finance Committee that law enforcement techniques employed in investigations of criminal conspiracy as defined in Senate Bill 19 should be consistent with the protections against police entrapment under 1181-450?
If I understand that correctly, entrapment is frequently raised as a defense in federal conspiracy cases. The typical situation is in a drug case where an undercover officer, a reserve officer, or an informant goes to some person and pesters them, can you get me some drugs, can you get me some drugs, and finally, you know, I'll pay you lots of money, and finally the person says, well, gosh, you've asked me five times, you've offered me twice the market rate, yeah, I'll come up with cocaine, because I suppose anybody in Anchorage could figure out a way to obtain cocaine if they had half an interest in doing it. In a case like that, undoubtedly you'd have an entrapment defense. And in the example I just gave, I think that defense would succeed. Prosecutors on those facts should not bring the case, should not charge the case. They should tell the cops to back off, straighten up, or they'll be the ones who we go after.
But reading our current entrapment laws, it would be okay for the policeman to be the one that got the person to agree to this crime?
Well, entrapment law can become complicated. It sometimes is complicated in front of juries, but one of the things the state would have to prove in that example where someone agrees to do something with a police officer is that the person who, quote, is selling cocaine had a prior disposition, that it wasn't, that the initiative did not come from law enforcement. You know, driving down the street, hey, anybody want $500 for 1 gram of cocaine, that kind of a thing. So I think this letter of intent is simply saying that the entrapment laws that have protected Alaskans for years would also protect them with regard to conspiracy laws.
Okay, I'm going to move things along now. Mr. McNally will be here to answer technical and detailed questions.
Chairman,
before you go, though, Mr. McNally, we have some others. But I am trying to take as much testimony as we can today. And then from that testimony, at least in my concept, we should be drafting our ideas of what we want to see, and then at that time getting to the nuts and bolts and offer the amendments and so forth, instead of trying to do it with every speaker here. Representative Martin, then Terrio, and then Gusendorf.
That's just one question. It really has two parts. Mr. McNally, under the current Alaska statutes laws, would we be able to pursue a conspiracy case such as we see on the front pages involving the Olympic skaters, Nancy Kerringer, or would the new conspiracy law allow our law enforcement officers to pursue this, or court lawyers?
There are many examples in recent Alaska history. I think they've often been raised by law enforcement officers rather than prosecutors. I hesitate to use any specific example because we're talking about people who either were acquitted or people who were never charged with a crime, and so I properly should not refer to them. But the answer is, one of the great misunderstandings about conspiracy laws is everyone is under the assumption that it's a way to get at someone for another kind of crime, like solicitation laws or aiding and abetting laws or attempt laws. That's not what it is. The Ninth Circuit, Federal Circuit, which reviews Alaska's federal conspiracy laws, has said again and again, as has the United States Supreme Court, conspiracy is a separate crime altogether. And there's a difference between John Doe buying a gun, going to a bank, and deciding to rob it. That's one kind of crime. It's a bank robbery. But there's a difference when John Doe conspires with three other people, one to get the gun, so Doe can't be linked to it, one to drive the car, one to listen to the police scanner. That's a whole different kind of crime against society with all new dangers and much less risk of apprehension. So the answer to your question, Representative Martin, is yes, it would enable us to go after people who today are not prosecuted at all. And secondly, it's not just another way to get at people. It is a crime all by itself. And that's how it's looked at by the Supreme Courts of our 49 sister states.
But do we have a crime? You know, recently we had the Olympics in Anchorage for the trials. And it's a group of people were against Susie, who came in second place, but if she were potentially come in first place, and they did something on the trail. They put a wire across this trail and maybe severely injured her leg because she didn't see it, and it cut her severely and brought her out. Would we be able to touch it at all?
I'm afraid that the only answer to that question is the cowardly lawyer's answer, it depends. And it depends on a lot of factual questions that it depends on what the evidence is against which individuals and what they actually did or didn't do.
The evidence shows there's four people involved in it.
If we could prove the elements of this crime, as is before you, beyond a reasonable doubt, we would charge the case. If we couldn't, we wouldn't.
Any Representative Terrio, then Grusendorf?
Well, I just think that as we consider the proposed, amendments on the bill and the bill itself, we have to be really mindful of the fact that, it's just not A, B, C, D, the person is guilty and he's locked in jail. There's a jury here. A jury, the prosecutors have to make their case. And as they're trying to make that case, there's a defense attorney trying to pick that case apart. And then 12 people get together in a room. I've sat on a number of juries. And, hash it out, So I think that the basic protection in our system is in the jury system. And so, just things are not going to turn just on one word here. 12 people have to get together and figure out whether the prosecution has made a case that's convinced them beyond the reasonable doubt. So I think we have to keep that in mind as we consider this legislation.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McNally, you had me with you up to a point. You had a pretty solid argument, and I was enjoying it and following along there. But then you slipped in your example that you gave to Representative Brown, where he had this conspiracy going on, but then in the end you had both at the scene of the crime committing overt acts. And if that would be your interpretation of this, is my assumption that every time there was a situation like that, you'd also slap him with the charge him with conspiracy and then run it down and at the same time think that that's not going to cost money. In other words, if Mr. Big showed the plans, the timing, where to go, and gave it to Mr. Small and Mr. Little, who then were the ones in your example that did it, then I can see conspiracy. But what the example you gave there that got me jumping out of my seat there, it appears that, unless you misspoke, it appears that you would be levying this charge every time there's a crime committed.
May I answer?
Please. Well, I hope so.
Okay. In that particular example, two guys clearly doing a bank robbery together and committing it.
Leaping over the counter and doing things, yeah.
Okay. Right. First of all, there are two crimes being committed, in my view and in the view of most of the laws in the United States. And it goes back to what I just was describing to Representative Martin. If I go in and rob a bank alone, that's one crime, but if I team up with one person, let alone four people, it's a different crime, a separate crime, the crime called conspiracy. Right now, as written, the conspiracy law is generally one penalty less than the actual crime. And there are two advantages to the legislature crafting a law like that. I think it's been very well thought out. One is, we're always after Mr. Big, especially in the world of narcotics. And very, very commonly, in a case, you might charge those two with robbery and with conspiracy. Typically, we want to offer them something. We want to make it worth their while to do the right thing and cooperate with us. So a typical plea would be, okay, we're going to make you a deal. Instead of being subject to the higher penalties of robbery, we're going to let you go down one step to the conspiracy. And it does two things. One, for playing ball with us, you reduce your exposure for sentencing. But almost as important, when you go before the jury testifying on behalf of the state about the crimes of Mr. Big and others in it.
But I added the element of Mr. Big. You did not.
Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't, sometimes there is and we can't prove it. But the real advantage in co-conspirators, I guess the most recent example is this Loomis armored car guard who was murdered in an armed robbery in Anchorage. Three different partners in crime testified against him. And one of the advantages, and they pled to a variety of things, some of them which frankly were a bit artificial. It would have been vastly preferable for each of them to enter a plea of guilty, or no contest, to the crime of conspiracy. It gives them added credibility when they testify to the jury about, in that case it was a Mr. Big's role, and say, there was a conspiracy. I not only admit it, I'm not only here to tell you under oath about it, I pled guilty to it, ladies and gentlemen. And I'll tell you my role, and I'll tell you the other people's role as well. So on an evidentiary level, as well as in terms of the simple justice of the whole story, there's an advantage. Your question whether we would routinely add a conspiracy charge every time we nab two people in a robbery or a drug deal, whatever, is something that would need to be addressed by all the prosecutors once we see the law as it actually comes out of the legislature. And more than...
See, what you're saying now would follow through with your argument and example that you gave to Representative Brown.
Sure.
That's enough, Mr. Chairman. Thank
and,
you.
And for whatever it's worth, more than a year ago, the Fairbanks District Attorney, Harry Davis, urged us all to be looking toward a task force as soon as we know what a conspiracy law is actually going to say, for prosecutors around the state to call a timeout, look at it, and decide exactly how it should appropriately be used in Alaska courtrooms.
Okay. Quick question, Representative Brown, and then we're going to go to Mr. John Cellini.
Do we have plea bargaining in Alaska now?
Well, we have charge bargaining, which for most people's sake is essentially the same thing, where someone is accused of an A felony, and in return for providing evidence against partners in crime, for giving up the right of appeal, whatever else, that are routinely permitted to plead, for instance, to a B felony. That's a very common practice. And Charlie Cole announced in a major address to the judiciary in Juneau, I believe it was in June of 1993, that he, as Attorney General, was lifting the ban on plea bargaining. I would expect that a written follow-through on the Attorney General's announcement will be put out at some point. I know it's still in the works, and it isn't all the T's aren't crossed and the I's dotted, but charge bargaining has existed in Anchorage, I mean, throughout Alaska for at least 10 years.
Representative Navarre.
With respect to the crime of conspiracy, if you had two people who robbed a bank, they both got caught robbing the bank, inside the bank, they'd be charged with bank robbery and conspiracy, right?
They could be.
I mean, wouldn't any prosecutor do that? In order to, and then make them, then say, well, we'll drop the conspiracy charge, And you just plead guilty, right? Instead of taking both of them, you add them together, right? You add the penalties together. And so it's actually could be. And if you have one person, you mentioned that in your earlier testimony that there would be one, two, or three defendants. You meant one extra?
No.
So one person can be charged with conspiracy?
There are routine narcotics cases where, for instance, on wire, the person who's actually doing the hand-to-hand selling is referring to his source or his suppliers or any number of other people who have never been identified by law enforcement, and they might still be charged with co-conspiring with persons unknown.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McNally. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure we're going to have more questions of you.
I'm available at any time.
Thank you. Mr. Cellini.
Can you hear me, Chairman?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. I know you're extending this hearing. First of all, my comments will be directed mainly to the fiscal impact, even though you suggested you want to hear otherwise. But I will talk about the merits of the bill as part of my testimony. First of all, the prosecutor has expressed some ambivalence over the years regarding how he will use a conspiracy law if it is passed. Currently, Mr. McNally, the representative for the government, seems to indicate that not many new cases will be charged. However, in 1989, when the Department of Law was reacting to a conspiracy bill which was much more limited, it was only directed to drug traffickers, the prosecutor said in their fiscal notes, in their analysis, and I'm quoting, a conspiracy law will not decrease the amount of work involved in pursuing drug traffickers. Rather, conspiracy prosecutions will require the investment of significant time and effort on the part of the state prosecutors. Right after that, it says, in quote,
In addition, a conspiracy law will not cure the problematic and expensive practice of granting separate trials to co-defendants. And I think that's a recognition of the Bruton problem that Mr. McNally referred to. Mr. McNally has conceded that there are people in Alaska today who they could charge if conspiracy was the law, who they are not charging now. He also concedes that conspiracy is different from aiding and abetting, is different from solicitation and theories of accomplice liability. In other words, it's a new and distinct category of crime, much like possession of marijuana became a new crime category again in Alaska not too long ago. And though this district attorney seems to assure us that there will not be an appreciable number of new cases, can he assure us that a year or two from now, a new generation of district attorneys will not use the conspiracy law in a new, creative, or different way? Mr. McNally also concedes that in rural Alaska, they would use conspiracy not only to get at those people who, I don't know if he calls them mules or just the sellers who are selling in the bush, but also will reach down to Anchorage. Now, this may be a very good use of criminal prosecution efforts, but what McNally says by implication, then, is that there will be additional cases. And it makes sense that if someone adds the law of conspiracy to the books in Alaska, that new cases will be made. One thing that hasn't been addressed is the potential for using conspiracy cases related to increased gang activity in the urban areas, especially in Anchorage. And obviously, groups such as gangs are the target of conspiracy laws. And we would expect here at the Public Defender that a number of new cases might be made by prosecutors related to gang activity. It is difficult to get a sense of to what extent this law would be used if it was passed. We think the 1989 fiscal note, which I referred to at the beginning of my testimony, that of the Department of Law, accurately and generally reflects the increased effort which is needed on the part of all involved in the criminal justice system to process conspiracy cases. Last year, when the Department of Law testified regarding this particular bill, it indicated it might be making as many as 30 to 36 additional cases. Obviously, it's somewhat speculative to try to put a number on this, but the fact of the matter is there will be some increase in the level of prosecution if conspiracy becomes law. There's this suggestion on the part of the Department of Law that conspiracy law will actually save the criminal justice system money. And to the extent that there are consolidated trials, perhaps that might save some money for the court system, although I doubt it. And then there's this suggestion that there will be more plea bargains and therefore less trials and more money saved. Again, I refer you to the 1989 fiscal analysis of the Department of Law, which says that the conspiracy law will not cure the problematic and expensive practice of granting separate trials. But besides that, I don't think that conspiracy law will likely result in less trials. Mr. McNally said, guess what, there won't be any trials or something to that effect. And later on, he referred in his testimony to the Cars case where the Loomis guard was killed and in a robbery attempt. Well, in that particular case, the idea of the conspiracy law, and if I follow it, is that you get plea bargains and some cases don't go to trial because everything's going to come in and the defendants and their lawyers say, gee whiz, we have no chance of beating this case. But in this Cars case that I'm referring to, and to which Mr. McNally referred, at least three individuals who were involved struck plea agreements with the prosecutor. One is Kingpin, or the big guy, who was actually the shooter in that case, went to trial anyway. Only one defendant in trial, the case lasted more than 6 weeks. If there had been one or two others who had decided not to strike a bargain with the prosecutor or hadn't been offered one, I would suggest to you that the synergistic effect of having two or three defendants in the courtroom and with their lawyers would have increased the size and length of that trial a great deal and would have been a very expensive proposition for the criminal justice system. You should know that in Anchorage, the largest city in Alaska, we only have three Superior Court judges who try criminal cases. And to lay a 6, 8, 12-week trial on any one of them creates absolute chaos in the calendaring of criminal cases in a given year. I want to talk about the merits of this law with respect to this reference to plea bargaining. Mr. Conheady, who's a former prosecutor, said that conspiracy laws are ultimately used to gain a stronger bargaining position. Well, there is a downside to plea bargaining, and I'm sure it was in recognition of this downside that the Attorney General back in 1975 banned it. We saw this actually happen to some extent in that Loomis case. I was involved in that case as an attorney, and what you find is that people who are trying to strike bargains with the district attorney's office, people who are involved in criminal activity at some level, tend to minimize their own role so as to sell themselves and to try to reach an agreement so that they can avoid punishment or avoid a more severe punishment, and they tend to overstate the role of other people. Sometimes they actually bring in people who are not involved in criminal activity because they're frightened to finger the right person, knowing that person has the power to make their life very difficult. So what I'm saying is, in an effort to achieve plea agreements, sometimes the prosecutor does just that, but at the expense of truthful testimony and a truthful presentation. I've talked to my colleagues in the federal system, defense lawyers who try cases, and they assure me that conspiracy cases, some go to trial. They are very expensive and very, very unwieldy forms of litigation. I also want to refer to another case. Mr. McNally, on two occasions now, has used the elephant analogy to discuss separate trials and the fact that the jury sometimes is misled because they don't see the whole picture. Mr. McNally concedes that he's only been in Alaska for a short time and part of the federal system. I think he's probably tried less than 10 cases. I've tried many more than that. And I can tell you about a case that most of you would be familiar with, and that is the shooting death of Alaska Airlines pilot Robert File. Neil McKay, a former prominent lawyer in Anchorage, was charged along with, I think, five other co-defendants, and I represented the shooter in that case. We didn't have a conspiracy law then. There were several separate trials, and everybody but Mr. McKay was actually convicted. But the point that I'm trying to make is the elephant analogy failed miserably when you start talking about actual cases in Alaska, because everything that had gone on between the people who were involved in the getting of the gun and the planning of where Mr. File would be shot and the statements which were made apparently to Mr. McKay and from him came in each of those trials. The fact of the matter is the rules of evidence allow investigators to talk about a great deal of surrounding circumstances involved in investigations of this nature, and you don't need a conspiracy law to give the jury a picture of the fabric and the tone of the investigation. Conspiracy cases may save money somewhere down the road for the court system or the prosecutor or law enforcement. I'm not involved in any of those entities, so I can't speak to those. But I can tell you this. I've spoken with a lot of defense lawyers who are involved with conspiracy cases and who have tried them. And the fact of the matter is Mr. Conheady, a former prosecutor, is right. The billing, he said, was four times that which you might ordinarily see when a defense lawyer gets a hold of a conspiracy case. And I'll tell you why. It's not because they see a deep pocket who they wish to bill, but these cases are very labor-intensive. A typical felony case, when a defense lawyer gets the investigation reports, the reports probably sitting on his or her desk are about an inch thick. They fit in a manila envelope. You get a conspiracy case, and when the prosecutor releases the investigation and the surveillance tape and the search warrant applications and everything else that relates to the 2, 3, 5 co-conspirators or co-defendants, you will have to send somebody to pick up the investigation materials because they're going to be in bank boxes. And reviewing that kind of material, those kind of investigation reports, that volume of material is very time-consuming. The other thing that one needs to know about conspiracy cases is they always do relate to serious felony charges. So, of course, you have to hire lawyers who can do experienced felony work, and that translates into money when you're looking for experienced lawyers, either as an open contract lawyer or as a public defender staff attorney. The next reason that these things are expensive from a defense perspective is that there is a considerable investigation which must be done, even if the case was later going to result in a plea bargain or a failure to go to trial. And that's because there are always multiple players involved, an expanded pool of people to interview. Now, of course, law enforcement does the interviewing and the investigation and the undercover work, but defense lawyers cannot rely on the investigation of the troopers or of a DEA agents. They have to undertake their own investigation from a defense perspective. Now, in the Public Defender Agency, we only have 10 investigators presently on staff, and that's statewide, and we have 13 offices, so spread out, we don't even have one per office. We do, the Public Defender Agency does 17,000 cases a year right now with 54 lawyers. So an expansion of our most serious kinds of cases, that is serious felony cases, will result in taxing not only the lawyers but our investigation staff. And you really almost have to know the litigation experience to appreciate this, but then you get into the pretrial phase of these kinds of cases, and that's where lawyers have to do legal research to determine what pretrial motions have to be brought, whether to sever, move to sever a trial, move to suppress certain evidence, move to vacate search warrants, which they may feel are invalid. You'll find that in these kinds of cases, the work involved in pretrial preparation and the filing of motions is much, much more extensive than that in your typical felony case. In fact, in many typical or garden variety felony cases, no motions are filed. But in conspiracy cases and talking with people who actually have been involved in them, there are always motions which are filed. Part of the reason is because defense lawyers play off each other. Somebody files a motion, someone else joins it and files an extended theory of that motion. And defense lawyers, as they see each other's work or meet to discuss the case, become even more creative, probably under the theory that several heads are better than one. Finally, related to pretrial motion work, you'll find that in most cases you have to have what are called evidentiary hearings. And those are hearings where the judge not only hears argument, but before he or she hears argument, will likely have to hear the testimony of one or more witnesses. Evidentiary hearings tend to be much, much longer as we get two or three people involved with their lawyers. And, of course, with more motion work before the court, the hearings are also longer for that reason. Finally, and people have made this point before me, the trials are also quite long, and as Mr. Conady says, can be very expensive for the government, especially if they're having to hire through a state agency defense lawyers, as is the case in OPA, or to provide staff attorneys, as is the case in the public defender office. When you have people who have struck agreements, who are involved in criminal activity, and then who reach plea bargains with the state, their credibility is instantly at issue for the reasons that I had mentioned before, including that they're trying to avoid punishment themselves. They're pointing the finger at somebody else. The defense examination of those individuals tends to be very lengthy and involved, and it also relates back to the investigation needs of defendants, because those people who are informants, although they're co-conspirator informants, their backgrounds are checked very thoroughly to determine whether there are areas which merit cross-examination so that the jury can determine their truthfulness or credibility. So in the end, what you do is you find that there will be several defense attorneys involved in these cases. Contrary to what Mr. McNally says, they will go to trial. And that doesn't mean that everybody will exercise their option of a trial, but if it involves only one or two, you'll find that the level of trial in terms of its length is much more significant than your garden variety felony trial, and that the fiscal impact on the defense, at least, will be very significant. In terms of our own fiscal impact, we try to take a very conservative view. We think that because these cases can be made all over the state and that different district attorney's offices will take different approaches, perhaps, for example, Harry Davis in Fairbanks may have a different view of of what might qualify as a conspiracy case and what might be properly brought. We're going to have to divide the state into two halves. We'll put one lawyer who will do conspiracy cases in our Fairbanks office and one lawyer in our Anchorage office, and we'll provide them each with some minimal support staff, that being a paralegal type investigator and a clerical secretary person. We think this is a conservative approach, it's a credible approach in light of the workload that would be facing us if this bill were to pass. I know I've spoken mostly about the fiscal impact. I've tried to talk a little bit about the propriety of using these kinds of cases. I know that in talking with one colleague, she was very concerned that there might be potential abuses in rural Alaska because of the smallness of the communities, the fact that people do associate with the other, and that people who were actually innocent but who may have associations with people involved in criminal activity, especially drugs, would be sort of caught up in this wide net. I have heard Ray Brown, who testified previously on this bill and who apparently is not available today, a former prosecutor and former defense attorney, discuss, and he has, I think, handled as a defense lawyer conspiracy cases in the federal court, talk about the potential for abuse because agreements can be tacit. Mr. McNally at one point in time said we would prove some of these things by inference. And when you're starting to prove things by inference, the potential for abusing the process becomes obviously much greater. One last thing, Mr. Brown, had he been in a position to testify today, I know he was available last Friday when this bill was first called before the committee, had informed me that the federal courts apparently are taking a second look at conspiracy cases and the way that they're conducted in the federal courts because of the enormous amount of time that they take up, and they're doing basically a cost-benefit analysis. This doesn't directly speak to the propriety of passing the conspiracy law in this state, but it does speak to the potential for tying up the court system and for the extraordinary expense, both for the public defender and the defense.
Thank you, Mr. Cellini. Do we have any questions? Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about the possibility that the legislature may pass this law and not pass the associated fiscal notes. And I wonder if Mr. Cellini could address what that would mean to your agency if the law were to pass, but the money it described in your fiscal note were not to be provided.
Well, what would likely happen is that there are lots of things. I'm not going to try to create a list of horror stories. But if we get a significant increase in the amount of our workload, and that might be only several more cases in terms of serious felonies, given our present workload, we would do the best we could. The first thing that would happen is we would probably have to ask for considerable postponements of cases so that we could be adequately prepared. Of course, that presents other difficulties because the longer you postpone a case, there's this old saying that sort of postponements always benefit the defense, but the longer you postpone a case, prosecutions do tend to lose their inertia. Part of the reason is because some of the critical witnesses, especially in these co-conspiracy cases, if people are out of jail, they may try to find a way of leaving the jurisdiction. Other critical witnesses, their memories may fade or be subject to some adjustment on cross-examination, for lack of a better term. So the first thing that you'll find out is there'll be some postponements on the part of our lawyers because they won't be prepared. You know, the trial date will come and they won't even have gotten to the third bank box of discovery, or maybe to the bottom of the first bank box if there's only one. And that can actually compromise public safety because it can hurt the prosecutor. And you can talk to Mr. McNally about that. That's why it's not unusual for prosecutors to oppose motions to continue or motions to postpone trials, because it does hurt the prosecution effort generally. The second problem is that if we're forced to go to trial unprepared, what it can mean is that we're going to generate a whole bunch of litigation related to ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Assuming that the person is convicted, he or she will then, and sometimes rightfully so, complain that the lawyer didn't spend as much time on the case or with the defendant as he or she should. Sometimes, in fact, they assert that the lawyer wasn't prepared, and so they actually pled guilty or no contest rather than go through a sham trial. Finally, the ineffective claim, well, I wouldn't say finally, but ineffective claims can also lead at times, although this is very rare, to civil suits against the state based on not wrongful prosecution, but wrongful imprisonment. This has happened, I think, on one or two occasions during the time that I've been director of the Public Defender Agency. If our workload becomes somewhere such that we're unable to do the casework, we would have to consider turning away cases. And, of course, all of our cases, we're a caseload-driven agency. We have no ability to affect the level of our work. We have to take every case that comes through the door that's referred to us by the court system. It's the court system that makes determinations as to the eligibility of a particular client. But in other jurisdictions, when the public defender has reached the crisis stage with respect to their workload, they've said they're taking no more. They've essentially shut down the door, and they've faced the possibility of contempt proceedings against the court. But usually what happens then is that the problem ends up in the lap of either the legislature, if they're the budgetary body, or some commission or panel or county seat, because the defense services, which are constitutionally mandated, have not been adequately resourced. By the way, Mr. McGee is here in my office if you wanted to direct any questions to him regarding the impact on his agency.
Any other questions to Mr. Cellini? If not, we thank you very much. And if you would give Ray West our apologies, I guess, when you see him, for not being able to get to him today, we're sorry. For everyone's information, tomorrow we have House Bill 58 on the agenda.